Well, I was born in Dublin in 1971 at the Rotunda Hospital.
Playwright Conor McPherson is the middle child of a family of three. He has two sisters.
I grew up on the Tonlagie Road, which is sort of between Coolock and Raheny,
on the north side of Dublin.
And I went to school. Coolock.
The young Northsider attended Chanel College, but was often distracted Chanel from College, his schoolwork by his extracurricular reading.
After books that I was always very interested in
were books priests, to do ghosts,
schools,
vampires,
Stephen King.
He was a saint, St. Peter Chanel,
French missionary who was killed in Fiji just back in the 1800s.
And never did my homework.
I was very posh. I could never understand
Appellation.
But when I look
despite
back now,
the impressive
I never
school
how
name,
I went to school
the young McPherson was interested in things outside his schoolwork.
Much when
happier reading
I was in school, I started to
Peter Straub, I remember.
Music.
There was always plenty of those kind of books in the house.
I mean, I got everybody in the house
guitar,
were
about
readers.
10 years old,
so I was always able to plow into
Beatles
whatever was there.
Time,
and there was no, there was never any control on that either, which was great.
I don't know what happened.
That just blew my mind.
I
wanted to
things like that when
to get a guitar.
Like, I mean, 11, 12, I mean,
I was devastated, of course.
Heavy stuff.
The young playwright was also gathering stories
but,
from another source.
When I was about 15, you start to play a guitar and that kind of thing, and stuff like that.
So
I was beginning to have dad's sense, I suppose, of doing something artistic.
He lived by himself.
I thought of it
consciously that way.
And really all my...
I used
my
to sit with him in this little house,
kind of
and it was very, very quiet.
Sort of,
especially in secondary school, I found it very
difficult with
to
stories
to see the point
about
when he
was
growing up.
I
remember him telling me
so
stories
forth.
About things like the Civil War.
I enjoyed
him
telling me
to an extent.
One time
I was
in the
house. And
there was a
struggled,
I think,
door,
with all of that in those teenage years. 14, 15.
There was a man there frantically looking for somewhere to hide.
And
he told me that his mother told this man to come just do what I wanted
in the house.
And then some
of
them chased
trouble in school
around there.
They shot him in the
car,
you know.
And
kind of
ghost
getting
stories
caught,
mitching
off classes and all that kind of stuff. And
very
however,
old.
Extracurricular reading was of great interest
in
to the young McPherson.
It was very natural. It wasn't
books
like
that
he was trying to tell a story that
was
made up.
I mean, these were things that really were real.
Stephen King,
that he knew.
After secondary school, the future playwright went to UCD, where his subject choice was based on what he thought would be the path of least resistance.
So the subjects
I understand
first year,
when I look back now,
I never understand how I went into school every day without my homework.
And
the trouble that you just
used
every
right,
single day, and I look back on it now and think,
it's no bother.
Would it not college easier to do it?
Maybe
but
an
edge, get my head around it.
People,
so much
whatever, I don't
happier reading.
Slowly, I began
like
to be in a way seduced
Peter
by
Straub, actually,
what
I remember
I
reading.
And
there was always plenty
of
those
plays
kind of books
which
in the house.
My
dad,
on modern drama, which
and
was at the end of
the
first year,
but in
the
house where
my readers,
you know, so I was always able to
plow
into
what
blew my
was
mind
there.
Really, and
there
was no, there was never
one
any
of the reasons was
that control on that.
I
understood for the first time
I
that it was a very special
like
kind of writing,
and
writing drama.
I was young, like
in that 11, 12,
followed the flow of thought,
heavy stuff, and
through dialogue.
Probably that planted
fashion.
Something,
and
I could go into all sorts of little
in my
ideas,
mind,
although
I
didn't realize that too much later.
He was also hearing stories from another source.
I came across
concept for a while,
storytelling,
I suppose,
for the first time
in
my life.
I thought maybe I
used to
try something
and
see
some early plays were written and performed by UCD Dramsock. And there was a decided shift in the attitude to study.
There
was
a
two-pronged
development for me,
which was
one was very scholarly, and
I began to
when I was about 15,
exams,
I started
win
to get
scholarships
from at the same time away from your plays and putting them on in the Drama Society and getting an enormous kick out of that.
And
learning
the train down to see him
all about
he lived by himself,
all the aspects of theatre.
Because I began to do little bits of acting.
I used to sit with him
in his little house,
doing all that kind of stuff,
and
I
used to sit.
The friends that I was making
the
in the Drama Society
and,
in UCD,
he would
we became
stories
very close in that we started
when
he was growing
up
together, not only
in
college doing
in the
1920s,
college,
in,
we called our little
in Ireland, he grew up fly by night
near Port Leash
in County Leash.
I first met Conor McPherson.
I remember him
in
telling
UCD,
me stories about things like
director
the Civil
of
War.
Loose Cannon Theatre Company, Jason Barr.
Conor and a few of my friends were involved in Dramsock, and Conor happened to have a play on called Scenes Federal. And one of the things I trying to remember was the opening scene. It was a kind of a fast-paced argument between two guys, and I had never heard dialogue like that.
Hearing these stories and stories,
also I found it quite different. His stuff, there was no real kind of traditional narrative.
He told in a way that was very natural. It wasn't like he was trying to tell a story that was made up. I mean, these were things that really were real and that had happened to him.
Kind of added up to some kind of story, which was also pretty exciting for me, being someone who was unfamiliar.
As a teenager, McPherson was a cause of some concern.
Well, Rum and Vodka was a play which
I
wrote and we put on first in 1991. It was the first play that I wrote as a monologue. I found a tremendous freedom in the monologue in that it could take us on a kind of an odyssey. I realised we could go up, down, in, out, into a person, out of a person. And I think they would have really the sort of world that it describes is one of a lot of pubs, a lot of parties, a lot of kicking against, I suppose, what young adults start to come across for the first time, which is responsibility. And
parents convinced me
I found it that play,
it
felt like very much a part of me, part of my consciousness. I knew from then on I was probably going to explore the things in a kind of a similar vein.
I was only 16.
And I began to
age, it's kind of
write,
tricky to know.
Really, I wrote a whole string of monologues after that.
In August 1994, I played the anonymous character in Rum and Vodka in a production in the City Arts Centre. There was a small bit of controversy that was starting to shadow Connor in terms of criticism. And I'm certainly one of these people who was arguing against him at the time, even though we were working together. And it was this kind of thing, is it theatre or is it not? Is it prose being recited or is it theatre? And Connor always very, very, very adamant, about the fact that it was occurring now, in front of the audience. It was somebody speaking to the audience about something that happened.
Bizarrely, like I was doing things like honors history, but I got an E.
That was what was secret.
You know, the kind of like, what was I doing?
The next play I wrote after Rum and Vodka was also a monologue, and it was called,
kind of strange,
at the time, I
managed
to
light
Jesus.
When I wrote that play, myself and Kevin Healy decided to put it on in City Arts Centre. It was kind of a disaster because we didn't really know what we were doing.
The writing that was happening at this time gave little hint of a future playwriting career.
Any writing that I did when I was doing, but as a teenager, was very, very difficult just to get people to come.
Music and writing songs.
It was very difficult to get reviews.
I wasn't writing anything that was meaningful, really.
The theatre critic from the Sunday Times at that point, Mick Maroney, came to see the play, and he said, look, you know, you're about this playing ways, you need to be doing your plays in places like
town,
Project,
places
and you need to be,
old
which we didn't have a clue.
Like the Ivy Rooms,
it was actually, he was very
like
kind
that.
And he helped us we actually put a little showcase together of the play again
that,
and writing songs,
and
you know. So for me, it was all to do with
people.
I mean,
very, very generous thing.
Sometimes
to
for school, I've had to write
people came
an
essay to see it,
and
one of the
people who came to see that showcase was my cousin,
to be more interesting than
was an actor.
I saw Kevin Healy do the play in the Project. Actor.
I didn't find any particular encouragement there. I was always
struck
by it.
It was a fantastic story
and
a terrific character. And Kevin, for some reason,
McPherson
did
pass
his
exams
and
began
to study an arts degree at UCD.
It should be done again. And we put together a production and went to the Dublin Theatre Festival with it. And perhaps because I had some standing or whatever, they said, yeah, we'll let you in. We had to find a theatre. So we got a place called The Furnace in Fleet Street. And we made it into a theatre. And we put the show on, and it went very well. So later on, early in the next year, into the spring, we put together a tour of one-night stands, and a chap called Philip Jackson then acted as stage manager, chauffeur, producer, publicist, and the whole dog's body. And we changed the name, The Light of Jesus. I don't know why I didn't like it as a title. I mean, it's probably a good
name
or whatever like that. But
he
came up with the name The Good Thief, which I think is fantastic. I think it really, really describes the play.
The Slime Tree Bower was a play that I wrote in, I think it was 1995. Again, a play based around monologues, but this time it had three characters, a la, I suppose, a faith healer. Like, I wouldn't like to say that in any way I was trying to rip Brian Friel off or to overstate the influence, but certainly that someone had done that really allowed me to explore that I could have more voices than one voice. It was a play which came to me actually in a dream. I had a dream about two brothers. The characters in The Slime Tree Bower were Joe and
Joe was the youngest character who was a teenager, really trying to find his way in the world through sex and all the rites of passage. His older brother was called Frank, and he was a character who had decided to rob a bookies because his father, who owned a chip shop, owed a big debt. And then the third character was Ray, who was played by Connor Mullen.
I think at that stage, I don't think Connor had written any play that didn't consist of monologues.
Actor Connor Mullen.
Except, you know, they consist of a lot more than monologues, because they weren't monologues in the conventional sense.
Very easy fashion.
There was a sense of the experience of the telling of the story was as informed and reliant on the audience as it was on the actor. So it was a dialogue with the audience, a monologue on the stage. So a momentum and an intimacy develops between the actor and the audience member. Now, you also have the other actors in the play who are on stage with you. That was Ian Craig, who played Joe, and Frank, who was played by Niall Shanahan. There was a moment in the play, it's the only moment where the characters kind of actually
I first met Conor McPherson through a mutual friend of ours, Colin O'Connor,
which is artistic director of Loose Cannon Theatre Company. Jason Barry.
I was acting at the time in the College of Music. I was studying
and it completely demolishes
Connor and a few of my friends were involved in drama.
How this play UCD, is,
and they were putting
on
plays. And Connor happened to have a play on, which he asked me to get involved in.
Connor McPherson's play, This Lime Tree Bough, was sent to us at the Bush.
Joined rehearsals.
And there was something of a feeding frenzy.
One of the things I remember distinctly about that play was the opening scene.
London, Dominic Drumgoo.
It was a kind of a fast-paced argument between two guys. And I had never heard dialogue like that. Now, admittedly, I was kind of fresh-faced, and you know, I didn't know much about theatre. I hadn't widely read at all. But
as the rain was coming down, our ship door was looked at him and said, "So will you let us do your play?"
No, I don't know how much of it was me romanticising now, but I was affected by
the Bush. And it was a huge success there, and it was
fast and an enormous later, surprise for people. When I started to read David Mamet, because I heard the name David Mamet went around the group,
philosophical underpinning
Connor
ran
was
through
always
it.
Back
and it was such a success
days,
that we then commissioned a second
he spoke
play
very
on
highly
from
of
him,
Mamet,
which turned out to be St.
I think
Nicholas.
He even may have modeled
the inspiration for
St.
Nicholas
David
came
Mamet, but
in the same way
I don't know if he wants
James
me to be
Bauer
saying things like that. But he was certainly influenced by his writing and that kind of choppy idiosyncratic dialect. Also, I found it quite his stuff. And that, his stuff was quite episodic, you know. There was no real traditional narrative, and I sort of thought, in a way,
that
was kind of odd
that
for
was quite
me, new for me.
And a dramatic
the play was, you know, constructed out of a,
as we all suspect,
a sequence
they really
of kind of interrelated events that kind of added up to some.
I just thought, well, that's gold, you know, that's gold for me.
Story.
As I started to write this,
it wasn't a once upon a time.
The story would be that he fell in love with
this happened, and then this happened, kind of structure.
In a way,
which
for me,
was
it also represented his longing to
exciting
to be an artist,
for me,
and
being
that he was
someone
stuck
who
on
was
the other side of an abyss that he could never cross.
Coming into,
but I also found that as a writer, I found that a hugely sympathetic story,
pretty stimulating.
Began
the first play that
I fell in love with the character
play was called Taking Stock.
To be brave, and I
it was very much an imitation of
as far as he could into
this
into his fantasy.
Men really shouting at each other.
Stalk this
and then when I wrote the play I didn't really know what to do with it except to bring it to the Drama Society, and they said they would like to do it, but I really knew nothing about putting plays on, and they asked me who would direct it, and I really hadn't thought of that.
It's very much like many of my plays.
I realised I'd probably just have to do it myself because I didn't know anyone who directed plays, and I got on with it and cast it, and we managed to put it on by the skin of our teeth, and I really enjoyed it. And
the
from
Royal
that
Court
point on, really,
The Weir, that was the former artistic director of the Royal Court, Ian Rickson.
I'm still on today,
it was a very
really.
Simple commissioning.
And I continued to write plays
to Connor,
right through my college years. Plays that I wrote at that time were, I remember I wrote a play called Michelle
said,
Pfeiffer,
do you
which
think the characters
really didn't have anything to do
other.
With Michelle Pfeiffer. I remember
said,
it was
yes.
a play about a family.
That was the end of the conversation.
I did a play called
and
Scenes Federal, which was about
I
a number
guess 6 months later.
It was different. It was sort of like
I think that what was
a play with a wide scope, which was one of those plays
is,
which sort of tried to take in a huge spectrum
play,
of society
actually,
in little
it's incredibly
scenes.
Theatrical. If you look at the stagecraft in the play, how he introduced
at the same
world,
time,
how
we started
the play
this small group of us that had sort of found each other in
two,
in UCD.
Trio,
we started to put on plays during the summer outside of college
Finbar,
in places like the International
character.
Bar.
Valerie.
Little one-act plays that we did at lunchtime. I did a play called Radio Play. Did a play called The Stars Lose Their Glory.
But it has that thing.
Did another play called A Light in the Window of Industry.
It has
these were all plays which were usually set kind of in an office or a workplace and usually centered around some sort of, I suppose, to simplify it, some sort of ethical dilemma, people sort of having to cope with relating to each other.
I think it was the summer that he finished his primary degree and we were all meeting once, I think once a weekend, we ended up in Beauty
Ritual
Cafe on Grafton Street.
Contemplation
I remember
of death,
about six or seven of us all
actually
meeting up hungover on Sunday mornings to sit down and argue about theatre, you know, in downstairs Beauty's Grafton Street, which of course is gone now.
In a really balanced way.
And
really
there was lots of that. Lots of,
Jack is the owner of the local garage.
The first arguments were about the name of the theatre company.
Actor Jim Norton played Jack in Ian Rickson's first production of The Weir.
Roll Your Own was
close-knit group.
Roll Your Own Theatre Company was one of the names. Pretty, you know, pretty bad. But anyway, I don't know how Fly By Night came about, but that was the name, and we all went along with that name. And the first production.
The news is that
this
young woman is
play Connor wrote called Radio
knows
Play.
Who she is or why she's there.
I think we were all kind of
everybody
pushing
tells
and,
the story.
You know, there was a
the
tussling and
it required
and
tremendous
power
discipline on the part
what,
of all
you know, what
of
was
us
the agenda this
to actually
you know,
listen
but really,
totally
at the end of the day,
concentrate
it was Connor,
the
Connor's plays
the stage
that really.
And that's
became
what we tried
the focus.
To do
and
play.
Colin
because the
O'Connor as well,
play, of course,
who wrote a few plays that
Valerie
that were put
having
on.
Listened to these guys.
But, so we ended up doing radio play. And this was a sequence of sketches.
And her story
very, very light-hearted.
About the death of
looking
the
back at it. And very,
and
I mean,
the men
I don't know
totally
I don't know what Connor was doing at the time.
React.
I think he might have been just experimenting.
It's so moving as each of them in turn.
It
tries
was,
to
a, I suppose it was a
show
comedy, like a review, you know,
tries to show
a cabaret almost.
Affection.
And we did it in the International
and at
Bar.
At the end of the play, Jack is left
I remember
on stage with Valerie.
The thing I remember most distinctly about that production was that we were in the International Bar and there was a cast of 16,
a license
which was like phenomenal.
And the final story of the play.
We played about, I think we all played between us about 25 or 30 characters. And it was set in a radio station.
Innocence in a way.
Very
and
simple
one of the
structure. The guests came in.
Said,
each guest got progressively more and
like
more insane.
Irish recording
and then the interviews were punctuated with slices of life.
The success of The Weir.
I remember
at the time,
saying that somebody
me,
picking up a prostitute.
Oh, that must have really affected
and,
you.
Well, another
you.
Memory of that was
the,
we had
the
a curtain.
The success is.
Because
really
we were all jammed
nothing.
Into the hallway
so
between
the
toilets
really,
and the stairs in the International
I wasn't
Bar.
Anything and
16
was,
of us waiting our queue, waiting for our queue,
you know,
trying not to laugh
I
half the time.
I began to write a play
and,
which
because we were all, you know,
a certain
it was very,
darkness
it was great fun,
that
you know.
I
we had,
realized
there was
in
a curtain
me, and a certain fear that I had.
And at the end of each
it was
scene,
very much
a hand had to come off
alcohol
and switch the lights on and off for the blackout.
People in Ireland.
So you could see the hand coming up, you know, and hear the click, the audible click of the switch.
Obsession with
and, so
and
Connor at the time, I remember
began
there was a sketch that
play
went
Carol.
Around between us all. He called
the play
us
set in an
the
undertaker's
Masters of Illusion.
The
inner company.
One day.
We are the Masters of Illusion.
Confronted by his daughter, who he hasn't seen.
So that was radio play.
His problem really has been to do with
some lunatic religious fanatic.
really didn't pull any punches.
Copies
and I found
of
it a very,
Observatory
very
Romano
watch.
Every
perhaps
week
because even at that time too, I was beginning to understand that
Connor made an appearance
my own
or two
relationship with alcohol was
very strange,
not very healthy
characters.
And it was only the friends when that I was making in the Drama Society in UCD that I managed to come to terms with that very close, and that we started to work together. Not only in college doing plays, but also outside of the college, and we called our little theatre company.
Authority happened in 2001. It wasn't all that long after we finished
today
the run.
Still work in the theatre, some don't.
On Broadway. When
like
in the
Jason
Post
Byrne,
came this
very well-known director in Dublin
from
now,
Connor himself.
Who was an actor.
It's really a dream
him,
play.
He wasn't actually even in UCD.
Not told
he was someone that just sort of came in and was hanging around in the Drama Society. No one ever thought to question what he was doing there.
And he said, well, these
another
three
great
men,
friend was Colin O'Connor, a good friend of mine, who was also
God,
a playwright. And it was great having
Conor
a friend
McPherson,
who was a playwright.
And they can't leave
he was
the stage
a huge fan of Beckett,
who
used to talk about all
and
of that.
Of course, Conor was directing.
Another great friend
this,
was Kevin Healy, who went on to do
some acting. So, yes, I said, my only concern is
another great friend was Valerie Spellman, who also a very good actress, who I then directed in a film, actually, a few years later. But
and he said, well,
that group
think
was,
of it this way, they're not
was
written
very important
as monologues.
To me. Very important
when you start
indeed.
A long speech,
but a funny thing was happening, because in tandem with writing
and then you think of
plays, I also really began
like
to
beads,
become actually
beads.
A very good and diligent
have,
student, because I was finding that what I was
like the first,
reading
first
about
began
and
like,
you know, learning about was
not,
was
well,
about
was
life,
dressed.
Because I was studying philosophy,
I
which I found
breakfast
an enormously interesting subject,
brilliant.
And
I can smell
which really
breakfast
taught
beans,
me for the
sir.
First
another
time
words,
that
a smell
it's
can conjure up
not
the image,
only okay
image
to be kind of ignorant,
and that's
that
the way
it's
I worked on
probably
sentence,
better
sentence
to understand that
the interesting
you don't
thing about
know
working
an awful lot
on this
and
show,
that that's all right, because until you can accept that,
Stephen Brennan
you can't really learn anything.
Played Kevin.
It was a sort of
separately
a two-pronged development for me.
On stage, the characters never refer to each other.
And
we're all in our own little bubble.
Incredibly,
you know,
well in my exams,
he had this
and all of that there,
bell rang,
and win scholarships.
Bell rang,
and at the same time,
the
I was writing plays
forward,
and putting them on in the Drama Society and
retreat,
getting an enormous kick out of that, and learning
and of course,
all
as
about
the play develops,
all the aspects
you
of
theatre, that
because
all their
I began to do little bits of acting. I was
and
directing,
it's a truly
I was writing,
beautiful
I was doing all that kind of stuff. And,
about loneliness, I suppose.
Over the next couple of
loss,
years, managed
redemption.
To write Come On Over,
a few plays,
and a short
put them play,
on,
which I wrote,
and be in a few
as
plays,
part of three
and
one acts,
to
which were to be
form, in a way,
the
nucleus of a little group that came together,
were,
and probably the play
Jordan,
with which
play
I found
game,
what I think
real,
was, you know, my voice, which I can still hear and see in my work today, was with a play which was called Rum and Vodka. It was the first play that I wrote as a monologue,
Jim Norton
and I found tremendous freedom in the monologue, and that it could take us on a kind of an odyssey. I realised
it was at that time when all that stuff was really starting to come out
into a person, out of a person,
and abuse and the church.
It was a play which is very much steeped in the city of Dublin as I was getting to know it at that time, becoming an adult. And
in a way, I look at that play now, it's too on the money for me,
really tasting that kind of freedom for the first time.
But still an important play.
And also, it
really,
the sort of world that it describes is one of a lot of pubs, a lot of parties, a lot of
really
a lot of the kicking against, I suppose, what young adults start to come across for the first time, which is responsibility. And it has all those elements in it. I found it, that play
Stanley
was one which once I had done something there, I don't know, so it felt like very much a part of me, part of my consciousness.
And John,
I knew,
you know,
from then on
say,
I was probably going to explore,
but it's in the context
in
of
a kind of
a
similar vein.
So
and,
there's no direct address to the audience.
To
you're just talking.
Write, really,
well,
I wrote
to
a whole string of monologues after that.
In August 1994,
John was a man who hadn't talked to anyone for a very long time.
The
so he had about 2 years of grief
Vodka
to express
in the City Arts
to this man, which he duly
was directed
did.
By Colin O'Connor.
And the therapist character, Ian.
This was it was a bit
Michael
of a big
Hatton.
Deal for us at the time.
He started out the
Declan
play
Gorman,
really healthy, well,
who was
positive
running
starting
City Arts
business.
At the time.
And
he,
my man John was
came
deep
to Connor
in
He was interested in producing a production, a co-production
of three sessions.
So it was kind of like a big deal for us. It was the first time I think we were actually
somewhere around the middle of the second scene. We reckoned that John has become as healthy as Ian is now unhealthy. And so the two characters had mirror journeys, one from illness to health and the other from health to illness.
I began to become intrigued after I wrote Shining City
college environment
with Newgrange.
The play itself, Roman Vodka,
I wanted to write something which
it's a one-man
the essence
show,
of Newgrange, which for me was so mysterious.
It had a very kind of restrained
and women 5,000 years ago
unhistorionic style, which was, I think, to mark a lot of
astronomical
writing.
There was something so beautiful and magical about that.
Very, very, very heavily on narrative.
I tried to write a play which was to do with all of that pagan stuff,
a character,
which didn't quite work.
Standing
but
in front
then
of an audience,
started
alive,
to write another play,
and
which became The Seafarer.
Events,
The Seafarer is set
past
in a
events.
House in Balgoyle on
just,
Christmas
and they had
Eve,
just,
and
that
it's
they
about
had
a
just
man
been
called Sharky who has to come back to this house where he doesn't want to be. To look
so
after his brother who's gone blind,
monologue,
and he hates his brother and his brother
is,
hates him.
A man,
as the morning turns
to
afternoon,
he's talking about
they
this
go
event
down to
that
the pub and they come
crazy
back and they bring
over
more people back with
drinking,
them. And really what it what happens in the play is that the devil has arrived into the house as one of the people who's tagged along, and he is there to play cards for Sharky's soul.
Domestic
that's also
despair.
Based on obviously the Hellfire Club story, which had always intrigued me when I was growing up.
Tragedy.
And so the whole second act of
and
The Seafarer is the card
standing
game.
There.
In the end,
to the audience in a
managed
kind of
to bring the audience to a place where it all seems very, very dark
together.
And bleak. But what I wanted to happen
the course of
was I wanted the sun
strange,
to hit
event.
The centre of
and
the,
he's left.
The death and the darkness.
You realise by the end of the evening that he's actually
I don't want to say how we managed to make the sun come and hope come.
Well, he doesn't know what he's
going to
do.
Come because,
he doesn't know what he's going to do.
Although we've already done the play, and I'm sure there are people
here
who saw it at the National last year in London.
So the whole story takes place in the early 90s
of 2008.
It's a time
so,
where, you know, Bjorn again,
go and discover
we're kind of
and the
big.
The,
you know, a night out
in my
the town was like going to see Bjorn again.
Instinctively,
in the
human beings have looked for meaning.
There's lots of famous kind of pubs.
I don't know how it has to be something bigger.
I mean, they're kind of in lore now, but the Stag's Head.
I don't necessarily believe
the Norseman,
in a god who
features
has any interest in us.
Because he goes in quite a significant
know where the universe
crawl.
Came
I mean,
from.
But to me,
the mystery and the wonder
of
that
just
is,
an office
is enough. It's a wonderful, beautiful privilege to be a conscious
and,
being.
And starts
if
off
perhaps, and there is a chance,
this,
we are the only conscious
you know,
beings
this,
who know we're alive
terrible,
and that we will die. We
spiral.
May be
I think
the
it was
only
significant
part of the universe
because
that's
there was
aware of itself.
A small bit of controversy.
It's mind-blowing. I'll never get
to
the bottom
of
why
Connor
we're here. I mean, nobody will, but
you've
got to keep an open mind. It's like what Neil Young says.
Against,
he says, I'm just trying
at
to
the
keep
time,
the door open
we
and let
the
wind blow.
Together. And it was this kind
the
of
playwright's
thing.
Profile
you know,
was
is it
Conor McPherson,
or is it
the
or
contributors
is it,
were
is it not?
Jason Byrne,
because
Dominic Drumgoole,
somebody is
Gareth
Keogh, is it
Conor Mullen
being
Jim Norton,
or is it
Ian Rickson,
Connor
and Stanley Townsend.
Very adamant.
The programme was
compiled
and presented by Sean Rocks, and the producer was Kevin
Reynolds. It was occurring now in front of the audience. It was somebody speaking to the audience about something that happened, and that was the dramatic event. That was what was significant.
The next play I wrote after Roman Vodka was also a monologue, and it was called, at the time I titled it, The Light of Jesus, which titles for me, I'm always looking for something in a way which, I don't know, has a poetic resonance as opposed to is somehow indicative of the meaning of the play. I don't like to dictate what a play means. I like it to sort of hang in the air and the audience to make of it what they want. And when I wrote that play, myself and Kevin Healy decided to put it on in the City Arts Centre. We both saved up money. Kevin was working at that time teaching computer science. I was working in a shoe shop. And we hired the City Arts Centre for 2 weeks to put this play on and perform it. And it was kind of a disaster because we didn't really know what we were doing and nobody came. I mean, I'm not trying to say that the play was a disaster. I mean, we were both very proud of what we were doing, but it was very, very difficult just to get people to come. And it was very difficult to get reviews and so forth. And I remember that a theatre critic from the Sunday Times at that point, a guy called Mick Maroney, came to see the play, and he approached us, actually. I think we might have even been the last night of the play. And he said that, look, why, you know, you're going about this the wrong way. He says, you need to be doing your plays in places like, you know, The Project, and you need to be... Of course, we didn't have a clue. And it was actually, he was very kind, and he helped us actually to put a little showcase together of the play again so that people would see it. And he organised to invite a lot of people. I mean, a very, very generous thing for him to do. And people came to see it. And one of the people who came to see that showcase was my cousin, who was an actor called Garrett Keogh. And Garrett saw that play and he said to me, you know, I wouldn't mind having a crack at this. And at that time, Garrett was in Fair City and he was Mr. Clancy. He was a villain of the piece. And I knew that that was great because I knew that if he were to perform it, I probably wouldn't have the problems we were having with trying to generate an audience. And Garrett then suggested, if we were to do it, and he organised to do it in the theatre festival in 1994, he suggested that we should probably change the title because he felt that the title was very off-putting, and we sort of cast our minds around for a while. I suppose I was still looking for something, I don't know, biblical somehow, even though the play was very violent. I don't know, maybe to, I don't know, give it some kind of resonance, but we ended up calling the play The Good Thief.
The Good Thief was originally called The Light of Jesus. And this, as The Light of Jesus, it was performed in the City Arts Centre by Kevin Healy at the time. It was, again, it was another man speaking a monologue to the audience, and similarly, it was this kind of it was relating past tense events. And back then, I still hadn't quite got my head around this thing that that Connor, you know, the guy had a balaclava on, you know, he was in, and you'd ask Connor where, because one of the arguments all the time would be, where is this set? What, like, you know, us all wanting to have things in tidy boxes, and he would always say it's in the City Arts Centre. And he not in a smart ass way. I mean, absolutely fact. This is what's really going on. Somebody is standing here talking to you for real. That's it. That's all we know. And that's the drama. So it could be quite boring. But other times it was like a lot of the time it would be quite electric because of that. Because if you could clue into it, there was a very unnerving kind of sense of it kind of undercut histrionics, undercut the usual artifice of theatre, and everything was strangely and underplayed in an unsettling manner, and Connor seemed to favour that, you know. It was subsequently performed by Garrett Keogh. They changed the title to The Good Thief, and Garrett took over. And for both of those productions, I was actually operating slides. It was two twin slide projectors, projectors, and they were kind of a series of random images that bore no literal relationship to the events in the narrative at all. They weren't there as a means of illustrating the narrative. It was more like a kind of an abstract visual accompaniment that helped to evoke associations. A lot of the images were very associative. I remember a pair of child's runners, I think. Oh, or maybe I'm imagining that now. And they just kind of flicked on and off. And I think, in looking back now, I remember even how the sound of the projector and the slides changing was actually part of the texture of the performance. And, you know, it conjured up, I suppose, in retrospect. It makes me think of Harry Palmer and Get Carter or that kind of world, because it was, you know, he was a gangster, he was a thief, he was in the underworld, and there was some kind of sense of him being on trial, maybe, or He was being interrogated, and you know there was a kind of an ominous kind of forward motion, impassive to the machinery of the slide projectors. I didn't realise it had that effect on me at all now. So I think that then they took it on tour around the country, which I didn't go around with them then, because you know there were two of us operating the slides in the original production, and then it was downscaled to just me in the Dublin Theatre Festival when Garrett was performing it, and then when they went on tour, I think Connor went round and he did it himself.
I saw Kevin Healy do the play in the project on a special showcase. It was a Saturday afternoon. Actor Garrett Keogh. I was immediately struck by it. I thought it was a fantastic story, a terrific character. And Kevin, for some reason, who did it very, very well, didn't want to do it anymore. And that's a funny one. I thought it should be done again. And we put together a production and went to the Dublin Theatre Festival with it. And perhaps because I had some standing or whatever, they said, yeah, we'll let you in. We had to find a theatre. So we got a place called The Furnace in Fleet Street, and we made it into a theatre and we put the show on, and it went very well. Those who saw it said this should go around the world. Unfortunately, not enough of those people came to see the play, and we lost money. So later on, early in the next year, into the spring, to get some of the money back, and you know, for all the effort we put into it, we put together a tour of one night stands, and a chap called Philip Jackson then acted as stage manager, chauffeur, producer, publicist, and the whole dog's body. And he and I went around on one night stands. Connor came with us one night to the up to Derry, and we travel up all the time. We went up with Philip's car, and when we got to Derry, I was up the top of a ladder. Just in the lamps. This is how we did it, and Philip had, you know, be in the box doing it, and Connor was helping out as well. And the only prop there was a chair, which went in the car with us, and a bottle of whiskey and an ashtray and a few fags. And we had a problem with the whiskey because it was a bottle. And of course, I wasn't drinking whiskey on the stage. I was drinking apple juice. And to save money, Philip Jackson tried to stretch a carton of apple juice over two or three performances. And these performances might be a day or 2 days or 3 days apart. So sometimes the apple juice kind of fermented. And at the very least, it bubbled at the side and it became kind of fizzy. And I said, this is crazy. And in Derry, that's what happened. When we had a little run through of a scene or two, we poured it out and it beaded bubbles winked like champagne. And I said, it's the only prop. We have to get it right. So he went out looking for apple juice. And I don't know how, but he couldn't find apple juice in Derry. So we tried a tea, a cold tea. We tried a weak Coke. We tried all that. The problem was, once the apple juice had gone funny in the bottle, then everything else you put in took on those kind of bubbles as well. And it just looked so unconvincing. And I said, well, we have to do something. I said, just get a bottle of whiskey. And Connor said, what? I said, get a bottle of real whiskey, I said, and I will sip a couple of sips on the stage and all that shit. But I don't know. Crazy. So Philip went out and he got a half bottle of whiskey, and then Connor came around and thought, this is a terrific idea. He said, keep it in your pocket, in your back pocket. Don't take it out until a particular time, and then don't open it until on the stage, because when you crack open that metal seal, the audience will know this must be real, and they'll get that frisson. So we did, and of course, I was a bundle of nerves. I mean, I didn't drink that much of it, a couple of sips of it, but the adrenaline of not only doing the show, but of knowing that every time I took a sip of this, it was burning the mouth off me, and, you know, would I be able to get my tongue around all the words by the end of it all? But anyway, I did. Yeah, we changed the name. The Light of Jesus. I don't know why I didn't like it as a title. I mean, it's probably a good name for him or whatever like that. But he came up with the name, The Good Thief, which I think is fantastic. I think it really, really describes the play.
The Slime Tree Bower was a play that I wrote in, I think it was 1995. It was, again, a play based around monologues, but this time it had three characters in a la, I suppose, Faith Healer would have been an example, which would have, in a way, opened the door and would have allowed me to do that. It wasn't, I wouldn't like to say in any way I was trying to rip Brian Friel off or to, you know, to overstate the influence, but certainly that someone had done that really allowed me to explore that I could have more voices than one voice. And I began to write that play, and I began to realise how effective it was to write that kind of play, because you could actually, where you leave off and allow the other person to come in, leaves a little bit of a cliffhanger, and then you're allowing the next person to come in, and then they leave it on a cliffhanger, and then the next person. It was a play which came to me actually in a dream. I had a dream about two brothers who were on bunk beds, and they seemed to be talking about a robbery. And from there, that play evolved. And by this time, though, our fly-by-night theatre company had sort of begun to disband a little bit. This was kind of just before the Celtic Tiger, and there wasn't really any work. And my friends began to have to go away to places like Prague to teach English as a foreign language, or people just had to go away and earn a living. And I found that I had to, for the first time, really just put a play on by myself. It was the first play, actually, that I'd sent to places like the Abbey, the Gate, RTE, all of that. Didn't really get much of a response, and I realised I would have to just do it myself. So I auditioned people, and I was helped enormously by a man called Philip Gray, who was with a theatre company called Evoil Donoch at that time, and they had a kind of a residency in the Crypt Arts Centre in Dublin Castle. And the very first Dublin Fringe Theatre Festival was on, and we managed to get into the programme for that. The characters in The Slime Tree Bower were Joe, who was played by Ian Craig, and Joe was the youngest character, who was a teenager really trying to find his way in the world through sex and all the rites of passage. His older brother was called Frank. He was played by Niall Shanahan, and he was a character who had decided to rob a bookies because his father, who owned a chip shop, was owed a big debt to him. And then the third character was Ray, who was played by Connor Mullen. Connor Mullen's character was a philosophy lecturer, so I was able to bring in, I suppose, any concept that I liked. And but at the same time, he was an academic in the tones of books like Lucky Jim, or perhaps books by David Lodge, where you have academics who are in some way, I suppose, immoral, amoral, but somehow their intellectualism allows them to be that way, and they can justify who they are rationally. But at the same time, he was a character who was filled with a kind of inner sense of self-loathing.
When I first met Connor, I was doing a play in The Peacock.
Actor Connor Mullen.
A play called The Man Who Became a Legend. And I had been doing a lot of work sort of on the fringe at around that time. I'd sort of fallen out of favour with all the mainstream theatres. Not that I'd fallen out of favour, but I was kind of at that age. And it looked like I might be getting back into some of the mainstream productions. And I had been asked to go back into a revival of a play in the Abbey, and which I thought was probably a good idea. So we finished the performance in the Peacock that evening, and went over to the Flowing Tide. And this guy came up to me, who I'd never seen before. He said, "How are you? My name is Conor McPherson. I've written this play. Would you be interested in doing it?" And I said, "Well, yeah, give us a look at it, you know, no problem." So he left it in for me, or gave it to me, and I took it home and I read it. And I went, "Geez, this is, I think this is really good." And I thought, "Well, what am I going to do? I'm supposed to be going into the Abbey." And then I just said, "Well, you know, to hell with it. Go with the gut. And this guy seems pretty interesting." So I phoned him up, or I met him, and we talked about it. And he came out to where I live at in Howth, and we went up on the cliffs, and we started going through the play. I just knew this was something kind of special. This was going to be really, really interesting. And we did the play for the Fringe Festival in the Crypt. There was myself, Ian Craig, and Niall Shannon. And it was a remarkable experience. It was rehearsals were great, very liberating. He gives you a lot of responsibility, which actors like. And we did the play, and it did very well in the Crypt, but with a limited audience. So the next thing, the Bush Theatre in London got in touch and asked Connor if they could do a production, that they wanted to mount a production, which was a big feather in his cap. And to his credit, Connor said he would love to bring the existing production over to the Bush Theatre in London, but he wouldn't allow them to stage their own production. And in a way, I think it was kind of, it was a bit of payback for us. And so we packed our bags, we went to London and opened in the Bush Theatre to great acclaim. It was fantastic. We ran there for about, I think, four or six weeks. And that was, I think that was Connor's first London production.
The criminal undertones of The Good Thief and This Lime Tree Bower seemed to come from when I used to work part-time in a shoe shop in Parnell Street. We worked at the market stall shoe shops, which were at the back of the ILAC Centre at that time. It's all gone now. But Dublin at that time really was, there was a lot of dereliction and there was a lot of drugs. I mean, there are now, but it was different then somehow in that it seemed almost, it was almost an endemic part of the fabric of this, of society around those areas, Parnell Street, Dominic Street. So I used to see an awful lot of shoplifters and people getting arrested all the time, fights, rows, all of that. And I don't know if that's what played into, it showed me another world, which I suppose I was, like any young man, sort of intrigued by and sort of wanted to know what it was like and what it was about. And perhaps it rose to the surface in those plays.
Well, then the thing about Ray, who I played in This Lime Tree Bower, was, I mean, he comes across as a very sort of arrogant, almost insular character. And, you know, it's quite surprising to see him in a relationship with, who appear to be quite a kind of a normal family. He's going out with his sister Carmel, but he kind of he has more of a relationship with the two brothers, with Joe and Frank. Ray has this sort of sense of displacement that, you know, he's looking to the brothers to, I think, to give him something, to give him some sense of home. I think a lot of the characters in Connor's plays have this need to go home. And in Ray's case, it was literally, you know, to go home. And the brothers and the whole family kind of satisfied this, and they were like a security and a normality for him.
After Garrett Keogh had performed The Good Thief, I was approached by the filmmakers, Paddy Branock and Robert Walpole, who had a company called Treasure Films. And Paddy had won a prize at the San Sebastian Film Festival, which gave him money to put into a new film. And they wanted to do something a little bit like The Good Thief, I think. They saw that a crime kind of movie could be something they wanted to do. And I began to work on a screenplay for them, but it was an original screenplay. And I had never written a screenplay before, but I found that I enjoyed it and I liked working as part of a team. So I was working on the screenplay for what became the film I Went Down at the same time as I put on This Lime Tree Bower at the Crypt. And Paddy and Rob introduced me to an agent who was Joe O'Connor's agent, who they were friends with. And he came over to Dublin to have a scout around the Fringe Festival. He saw this play, This Lime Tree Bower, and we met up in the pub across the road, which was Brogan's on Dame Street. And he suggested that he would represent me and that we would try to get this play on in London. And that agent's name is Nick Marston. And I wasn't sure if anything would really happen, but within a few months, he called me up and he said that both the Royal Court and the Bush Theatre were interested in doing the play in London. So for me at this time, it was kind of make or break, because I'd been doing it now for a few years, not really making any money, not having, you know, little fringe success and so forth. And I was writing I Went Down, but it was still very far from being finished or even being made. So, and I was still kind of living off my parents and all of that kind of stuff. So when I got this call from Nick and he said, look, get yourself on a Ryanair flight and get over to London and come and meet these theatres. It was an amazing feeling for me. It was a wonderful experience, because at the same time as these theatres becoming interested in my play, Paddy and Rob had managed to get I Went Down financed through BBC Films and RTE and the Irish Film Board and so forth. So for the first time I was actually being paid, I was a professional writer. And so that would have been about 1996.
Conor McPherson's play, This Lime Tree Bough, was sent to us at the Bush by his agent,
former artistic director of the Bush Theatre in London, Dominic Drumgoole.
And there was something of a feeding frenzy over it at the time, because a lot of different theatres wanted it, because it was such a distinct and new way of writing theatre. So there were a number of different theatres who were after it. I was lucky enough to go to Anna McCarrig, which was doing a writer's workshop with a number of Irish writers, just at the moment when we wanted to sign the play up for the Bush. And Conor was there, and so I got to know him there. And towards the end of the week, I took all of the writers out on a different trip to discuss their various plays and different works. And at the end of the week, I took Conor out in a small boat into a lake just outside Anna McCarrig, and the rain started coming down, and I had the oars in my hand. And just as the rain was coming down, I shipped oars, looked at him and said, "So will you let us do your play?" And he was in a rather compromised position, and he had to say yes. So thankfully, This Lime Tree Bower came to the Bush, and it was a huge success there, and it was an enormous surprise for people. The spareness of it, the method of telling a story just through monologues, the wit of it, the dryness of it, the philosophical underpinning that ran through it. And it was such a success that we then commissioned a second play from him, which turned out to be St. Nicholas.
The inspiration for St. Nicholas came in the same way that This Lime Tree Bower had come in a dream. I dreamt about someone who'd been bitten by a vampire and was looking for some paracetamol tablets for the pain. And I don't know, that stuck with me for some reason. And I also knew that I wanted to write something about a theatre critic, because I saw them really as outsiders, and I saw them as longing to belong. And yet, by the very nature of what they did, were sort of exiles and excluded and kind of hated, really. And I sort of thought, in a way, that was quite a sympathetic and a dramatic situation to be in, because if, as we all suspect, they really want to be loved by the community that perhaps they criticise, I just thought, well, that's gold, you know, that's gold for me. And as I started to write this play, I realised that the story would be that he fell in love with this actress, you know, and he's a married man and he has a family who are grown up, but that he becomes absolutely besotted by this actress who he sees in a production of Salome at the Abbey. And in a way, for me, it also represented his longing to be an artist, and that he was stuck on the other side of an abyss that he could never cross. But I also found that as a writer, I found that a hugely sympathetic story, and I began to write it really in a way that I fell in love with the character, and I wanted him to be brave, and I wanted him to go as far as he could into his fantasy as he starts to, in a way, stalk this actress. And then I wanted him to encounter vampires, because for me, it felt like I wanted the play to go into a place where all bets were off, and that I could explore any philosophical concept that I wanted. Immortality, morality, lust, all of those things. And it's very much like many of my plays. It's the Orpheus myth. It's about the hero who needs to descend into hell to discover something about himself. And I found it very rewarding to write that play. I think it's probably my favourite play that I've ever written. There's something to me that has something very strong and original about it, and I was very proud of it indeed.
I read St. Nicholas, which is essentially a story about a critic for the Irish Times who becomes a vampire.
Theatre director Mike Bradwell succeeded Dominic Drumgoole as artistic director of The Bush.
It's a wonderful, wonderful story, and great revenge on the critics, and it's sort of slightly cheeky, and we needed to get a virtuoso to play the part. Connor's first idea was to get Dave Allen, the comic, to play the part. And I'd recently had dealings with Dave Allen, so I thought, why not? So we sent it to Dave, and he read it, and he said, it's brilliant. It's absolutely, totally brilliant. I would love to do it, but I can't, because I'm just too ill. He was getting ill then. So we sat round about thinking about who to get it. We wanted somebody who was major. And Connor said, well, what about someone like Brian Cox? We want someone like Brian Cox. And I said, why don't we get Brian Cox? He's mad enough to do it. And so it proved. So I sent it to Brian, who just moved to LA. And about a week later, I get this phone call from Brian going, "You bastard," he said, "I've just moved to LA and now I've got to come back and do this play." And he came back, and I think he and Connor fell in love because they worked together a lot subsequently. And they worked on this play, which was absolutely stunning. And we took it to New York, and then Connor wrote The Weir. So that was the sort of the take on it, really.
The Royal Court commissioned The Weir after reading Connor's first play, this Lime Tree Bower.
Former artistic director of the Royal Court, Ian Rickson.
It was a very simple commissioning conversation. I said to Connor, "Do you have an idea for what you want to write?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Can you tell me?" He said, "Ghosts." And I said, "Do you think the characters could speak to each other?" And he said, "Yes." And that was the end of the conversation. And The Weir came in, I guess, 6 months later. And it was a very profound journey. It was slightly apologetically programmed in a very small space on stage at the Ambassador's Theatre in the West End. And it ended up running in a 1,000-seater on Broadway. And a really amazing journey. The key thing, I think, for the theatre, for the Royal Court, was that it saved the Royal Court. The Royal Court was in dire financial straits, and I directed 13 productions of the play commercially for the theatre, which kept people in jobs and allowed us to have a big lottery grant and rebuild and to reopen our theatre years later. And I think that what was really wonderful about working on the play is people talk about it as a monologue-based play, but actually it's incredibly theatrical. If you look at the stagecraft in the play, how he introduces world, how choral the play is. You begin with one character, and then two, then it's a trio, then there's a whole build-up for Finbar with this other character, Valerie. It's incredibly deft and efficient as a machine. But it has that thing that all great drama has. It has mystery, it has contemplation of life, loss. And in order to animate those monologues, it was as much for us about the listener as the teller. And when you have four people listening to a story on stage, absolutely in the present tense, we listen as well as a member of the audience. And I really enjoyed working on that dynamic between speaker and listener as the drama moves forward and takes us into this sublime dimension, because I think all great drama is in some way about loss, and I think Connor's thoroughly concerned with loss. I think he's saying goodbye to an old island. Perhaps in some way he's saying goodbye to his grandfather, who I know was a big influence. And in a much bigger societal way, I think the play allows us to go through this ritual of contemplation of death and afterlife. Actually, we go through what the characters go through. And I think it shows us the kind of consolation of community and the real loneliness of grief in a really balanced way, and I think it's a really important play.
The Royal Court had been disappointed that I didn't do The Slime Tree Bower with them, and they offered me a commission to write a play, anything I liked, really. And there's often a myth around this that they asked me for a play that wouldn't be a monologue, but that's not true. They asked me to write whatever I liked, and I had the idea already to write The Weir. The Weir, for me, very much is rooted in those experiences with my grandfather when I used to visit him in Leitrim. And its inception comes from, I remember being in a bar with my granddad and seeing a man come in. There was no bar person behind the bar, I don't know where they were, but you know, in a country pub, they could come and go, it didn't really matter. But the person walked in, this man, this sort of farmer guy came in, big, you know, dirty farmer, and he walked in behind the bar, and he really made a pig's mickey of pulling himself a pint of Guinness. And I just thought, that is a great start for a play. And I realised also that ghost stories worked in the theatre. I'd realised that with St. Nicholas, but I thought I could do something which is scary, and I wanted it to be rooted in reality. And I could see this pub. I could see the guy coming and pulling the pint of Guinness. I could see the other people who were there. And I wrote this play where they took turns telling each other ghost stories. The condition that I had to write the play under really was that probably I wasn't going to get a chance to direct it myself, which worried me slightly. But the director who they had given me was Ian Rickson, who at that time had done a few things. He had done Mojo by Jez Butterworth, which had been a huge hit. And we met in a little patisserie around the old Compton Road, and we sat upstairs sort of crammed in against a wall at the table, and he took out the script which my younger sister had typed up. I'd given her £100 to type it up, and because I'd just written it longhand, and he went through it with a pencil. I think there was about two or three lines. I mean, I expected that I was going to have to write endless drafts, but he just questioned about two or three things, and that was it. The play was scheduled to go on in their smaller space, and he really was very careful, Ian Rickson, to include me in the production, and he kept flying me over to London to go to the auditions, and we began to put our cast together. Now, the play was supposed to run for 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks, and the production was so strong that I think we knew from the first preview that we really had something. And part of it was to do with the wonderful design, which was Ray Smith, who's a brilliant designer who I've worked with many times since. She basically put the audience on stage with the actors. We were all in the bar. We were all just sitting on higgledy-piggledy chairs. The capacity was 60 people. And so basically it was like sitting in a pub with this story unfolding in front of us, and it allowed the actors to give performances which were very authentic, real. The whole play takes place in real time. There's no break. It just starts and it goes right through in real time, and then it ends. And it was unbelievably chilling and moving, and people were crying and fainting, and it was just an extraordinary experience, really. And when I went home back to Dublin, you know, and I saw the reviews, which were just incredible, and Ian said to me, right, we've got to extend this for a week, and then it was extended for another 2 weeks, and it was extended for 9 weeks, and then they said, right, we've got to move it, and they moved it into the Duke of York's Theatre, and then they said, right, we've got to change the cast, and then 2 years later it was still running in the West End. I mean, it was totally unintentional that that would ever happen, and the audience made that play the success that it was. None of us had the idea that, right, let's write a commercial hit, but it just kept going and going and ended up on Broadway. And it was just one of those things. I don't know, everything was just right about that production.
It is an absolutely staggeringly wonderful play. And when I read it first, I remember thinking, it's very strange, I remember thinking, I have to play this part. And I thought, if I don't play this part, I'm going to die, because I felt that everything I knew about acting and the little that I knew about life was encapsulated in this play. I recognized the character of Jack immediately. It reminded me of my Uncle Tom from Wicklow, and my uncles up in Monaghan, up in Clonus, where I used to spend my childhood with my granny. These very silent, tough, hard-working men with a wonderful, dry sense of humor, but very kind of... they didn't talk very much. They obviously had great, rich, internal lives, but they didn't often share that with other people unless they had a couple of drinks, and then the songs would start, and then these wonderful stories. I remember my grandmother was a great storyteller, and my Uncle James told some wonderful stories. And he was one of those characters who disappeared for a month every year. And I remember asking my grandmother, where has he gone? And she said, he's gone to Caelian. In other words, he'd gone visiting, God knows where or with who, and then he'd come back, revived from his visit for wherever, and went on with his quiet life. So I really felt that I knew who Jack was. Jack is the owner of the local garage in this very tiny community in Leitrim. And it's a very close-knit group of men who go to the same pub every night. Jack comes in, pours his own drink because the barman isn't there, puts the money in the till, closes the till, sits down. So he's an honourable man. And from that kind of quiet opening, the various other characters come in and join him. And then the news is that there's a young woman who's arrived in town, and nobody knows who she is or why she's there, except they know she's from Dublin. And eventually this young girl, Valerie, young woman, comes into the bar. And the men, of course, are totally hopeless at a small talk. They have no social grace or charm. And the only way in which they can engage her and talk with her is to tell her stories. And, of course, they choose quite inappropriate, frightening ghost stories that terrify the life out of the poor girl. But they're doing their best from what they know and trying to make her feel at home. And each of them has a story. And the fascinating thing about the play is that everybody tells a story in the play. And it required tremendous discipline on the part of all of us actors to actually listen and totally concentrate on the person who was telling the story and give the stage to them. We had a wonderful director. Ian Rickson directed this play, and I've been very fortunate to work with some very good directors, but I would put Lindsay Anderson and Ian Rickson in the same bracket. He just created a wonderful atmosphere in which to work. And I remember very well, he used to give us little projects, a bit of homework to do in the evenings. And I remember one of the really crystal clear sentences that came out of all that, and that was, true listening is worship. True listening brings us in touch with what is unsaid and unsayable. And that's what we try to do in the play. Because the turning point in the play, of course, is when Valerie, having listened to these guys telling their outrageous ghost stories, decides to tell her story. And her story, of course, is about a real happening, about the death of her child. And the men are totally stunned by this. They don't know how to react. They don't know how to express their condolences at the fact that this young woman's child has died. And it's so moving as each of them in turn tries to show respect and tries to show affection for this young woman. And at the end of the play, Jack is left on stage with Valerie. And because she's been so open in expressing her vulnerability, something that he obviously all his life has tried to shield himself from, he feels that he has a license to tell his story. And the final story of the play is devastating when Jack tells the story of the girl that he loved and lost through his own stupidity and youthful sort of innocence in a way. And he tells a story of going to Dublin to this girl's wedding because she left the village and married a policeman in Dublin. And it's an extraordinary piece of mature writing from someone who was so young. I mean, Conor McPherson was, I think, still in his 20s when he wrote this play. And one of the critics said McPherson is like an Irish recording angel. And I think that absolutely explains what it is that he does.
I played the character of Jim in The Weir.
Actor Kieran Ahern.
He was an odd job man, basically, living on scraps from other people. One of the main characters who gave him work was the character of Jack, played by Jim Norton, who used to give him work in his in his garage or whatever. But he lived with his mother up the side of the mountain, and this was the main topic of conversation. You know, in Ireland, generally speaking, it's the weather that kicks off the pub conversation. In the case of Jim, it was, how's the mammy? And the mammy became almost a kind of, a symbolic, she became the mammy of the area, really. So that the kind of, the sadness about her slow death, somebody refers to her as, she's been fading fast for years. So she's in very sick, but she's still there, and very much she has Jim there to mind her and to see her through to the end. So he's got a certain level of stunted development or whatever. But in spite of that, he's not looked down on. He's very much an equal in this community. And if there's any sense in which he is economically less well endowed, they make sure that they compensate for that by skipping rounds and so forth. What I found fascinating about the play was, obviously, it's a community of people who are used to each other, and they're used to listening as much as talking, and they're used to silences. People commented in the first production how extraordinary the silences were, and people kind of going, God, they can't keep this going for much longer, or it'll sag and it'll lose momentum. But it didn't, because of the way how fantastically Connor had written it. But the strange thing, and it really hit us as time went on, was that the whole production depended on listening, not on how brilliantly somebody turned the story over on a particular night, but on the quality of listening. In fact, we all said the stories almost didn't work if somebody wasn't on listening form. You could spot somebody who wasn't listening properly. And it's I remember early on, I had the experience during Finbar's story. Finbar is the local he's the local auctioneer who has brought this woman from Dublin to the area. And during his story, which is a kind of a fairly regular ghost story, it's as the story begins to darken, he was telling about this girl who had a strange psychic experience, if you like, a ghost story. And I remember listening so intensively, and every actor wishes for this state, but not so completely, listening to the story that I became completely absorbed and sort of came back up for air after, I didn't know how long, 10, 15 minutes, and was wondering, is my line next? I was totally lost to the story. No, it never happened quite as intensively as that again, but it certainly, listening was crucial to the story. And my character tells the story, the most innocent man in the room, you would say. He provides a lot of unintentional laughter. But he tells the story of digging a grave for somebody who becomes identified as a suspected paedophile afterwards. He's digging a grave for this man, and as it turns out, the man walks out of the church and asks him to bury him in a different grave. And he shows him the grave, and it's the grave of a little girl. And there was a shock ran through the audience when he pointed to the little girl's grave and said he wanted to be buried there. So you can see the story went to an extraordinarily dark place, and the innocence of the man leads us to that point, and it's the most extraordinary person to bring us to that point. But the point that he brings, the character of Valerie, the young woman who's come down from Dublin, the point he brings her to is that he facilitates her in telling an even more shocking real story about the death of her daughter. And what's wonderful about the play is that it people communicate to each other in words, but in other ways as well. They reach each other in a compassionate way. My character, when he's leaving the stage, I used to love it when he goes to comfort her. He says, "I'm sure your daughter is safe and comfortable," which is a lovely domestic quality of word, almost sat in a comfortable chair, wherever she is. He acknowledges the mystery. None of us know what happens next. So there's this extraordinary wisdom and compassion that comes from just an old farmer up the side of the mountain kind of thing. So that was the magic of the piece, the way in which the very ordinary and the extraordinary lived together.
I was lucky enough to direct another play by Conor McPherson, which was Dublin Carol, which I think is his most underrated play. I think it's a really beautiful meditation on loss and mourning and, in some strange way, rebirth. Conor wrote the play and submitted it, and we did a little bit of work together on just trying to get it as dramatic as possible in terms of the wants of the characters, the collision of those wants, so that each character had a journey. And particularly the boy coming in, the way he, in his gentle way, pushes the protagonist, John, and how that then leads to this amazing encounter with his daughter, and then this sort of redemptive coda at the end. I think initially the first draft of the play was a sort of tone poem of grief, and I think increasingly it became much more a theatre piece, which I really loved directing, because I think there's a thickness to Dublin Carol which really pulls you in. It's dark, it's much less healing than The Weir, but nonetheless I think it does take you on a very surprising journey of redemption. It's set on Christmas Eve, and Connor playing with the ritual of Christmas and how it exposes your loneliness or your connection to others, how it somehow raises the stakes is very astute, and I think the possibilities for some gentle regeneration that can occur in certain rituals, we have very few of them left, is so delicately done in the play, and I think it's beautiful.
I played Mary in Dublin Carol that we did in 2000 here at the Royal Court.
Actress Brona Gallagher.
And Brian Cox played my father, and Andrew Scott played the boy that worked, the young man that worked in the Undertakers. I hadn't seen the father in 11 years, and she brings a message from her dying mother, who's on her last legs, who's dying of cancer, and I have to go and find my father. This piece of writing was so brilliantly targeted at people that can't communicate. And the directions that we were given in the writing in the first few days of rehearsals from Connor about when people meet up in those situations that haven't seen each other in years, we've all experienced it in life. You see it, you know that somebody's hasn't seen somebody, there's a backlog of stuff that hasn't been said. And this is McPherson's brilliance. He will begin a show with these two people meeting and the absolute magnitude of pain, this mammoth pain that these people are coming together to try and discuss. We don't even know if they're going to get to discuss it. We don't even know if they're going to get to resolve it. But what's amazing about his work, when he starts his writing and has timing and everything has its commas, everything has its little moment, his stage directions, just his very presence in a room, Connor's presence, Connor's eyes, Connor's complete clarity when giving you a direction or giving you help in a rehearsal room. These characters haven't seen each other in 10 years, and the father was chronic alcoholic, and this child is incredibly damaged. She's now a young woman, she's got a good job, she's trying to hold it together, but there she is with her dad, and they're in this very strange place at the back of this Undertakers, and the first thing he does is give her a whiskey, and she takes the whiskey because she's terrified. She hasn't seen the man, you know. And it's very, very little communication at the start, and that's his brilliance, you know. He just keeps she going. He slowly winds the wheel up, and then he's the master of monologues. And he has now, you know, obviously over the years, I think perfected the monologue, and some of his work now is just monologue. But in Dublin Carol, he just kept the cogs going and going and going, and then the steam starts to go, and the steam starts to go, and then the trains go off, and by God, if you don't know this story, you're going to know it by the end of these characters talking. So that was what's so wonderful about his writing. And, you know, from an actor's point of view, to play that, to have that journey of a character, which I found personally, you know, incredibly painful character to portray, because obviously every night I had to sort of have a bit of a breakdown on the stage, and you can't fake that. You know, you have to access somewhere in your head, even if it's a made up place, but you must remember that the wonderful writing that he has given us to work is all you need. Like any great writer, follow the story. Like all good actors, all well behaved actors on stage should tell the story, because you'll never be as good as the story if you don't behave. And I think that's what's brilliant about Connor. And he just gave me this image of the man at the bar. He took her out for the day, and she just gets so tired that she falls asleep under the bar stool, and he falls off the bar stool, and then the band guard takes her home. For a character in modern Irish theatre to be able to embody that side of Irish culture as well, and for people to talk about it, to talk about alcoholism, to talk about dysfunction within a family, these great young, you know, I mean, you have to remember how young a lot of these writers were when they wrote this stuff, you know, for somebody like Connor to have written this and for it to be so powerful, it's still shocking.
The success of The Weir, at the time people said to me, oh, that must have really affected you or changed you. And at the time, I didn't think that it had, but in many practical ways, it really did. I was able to, to rent an apartment that I could live in and have independence and all of that. And the success of it also as well, I mean, the problem with success is is that it really teaches you nothing, because to know that you've done something which has worked, you cannot really learn anything from that. Failure always generates, although it's very difficult to go through, always generates understanding, and you learn from it. So at the time, really, I wasn't learning anything, and I was it was quite confusing, you know. And I sort of began to write a play which reflected a certain darkness that I realized was in me, and a certain fear that I had. And it was very much to do with alcohol and the culture of alcohol, and how people in Ireland, as I was traveling around the world a little bit at this stage, that I could see that Ireland was different everywhere in its obsession with alcohol. And I began to write a play called Dublin Carol, which very much explored the darkness of that. And I mean, that play is relentless. And in some way, I was nearly trying to do something which was the opposite to The Weir. I mean, I was trying to do something which was going to be an ordeal for the audience. I mean, I really wanted to put them through the ringer. I suppose I needed to get myself back into some place that I felt comfortable in, and maybe I didn't want to be successful. You know, I wanted to be somewhere that I was always struggling and having to figure it all out. And when I wrote that play, Ian Rickson was very eager to put it on and to direct it, and he did. And Brian Cox was very eager to be in it, and we had a wonderful cast. We had Brian Cox, we had the brilliant Brona Gallagher as playing his daughter, and we had the lovely Andrew Scott. And the play is set in an undertaker's office on Christmas Eve, and it takes place just over one day. And it's about a man who's being confronted by his daughter, who he hasn't seen in many years. And his problem really has been to do with alcohol abuse, and a very, very common story. And there's no family in Ireland that doesn't know something of its trouble. And I really didn't pull any punches, and I found it a very, very difficult play for me to watch. Perhaps because even at that time too, I was beginning to understand that maybe my own relationship with alcohol was perhaps not very healthy. Took me a while to figure that out, but that may have been one of the reasons I found it quite difficult to watch. And it was only when I gave up drinking a few years later that I managed to come to terms with that play by actually directing a production of it myself in New York at the Atlantic Theatre with Jim Norton. And I found that a hugely, hugely cathartic and rewarding experience to do that, because I had been so frightened of what was in the play that to be able to get into it, direct it, face it every day and put it on, and for it to work, somehow I'd beaten something within my own life. And I felt much stronger actually after that.
Dublin Carol was a great success when it was produced in London. Brian Cox, who's a great friend of mine, play the part of John, and I went along to see it, of course, and it was just terrific. And then some months later, I had a phone call from Connor McPherson, and he said, "Would you like to go to New York? We're doing Dublin Carol over there." And I thought, "You mean you want me to play John?" He said, "Yeah, we'd like to do it." So I said, "Well, I'll swim most of the way, and I'll walk over at last the rest. Of course, I'll do it." So I headed off for New York, and it was just wonderful. We had a fabulous cast, a very good actress called Kerry O'Malley played Mary, and Keith Nobbs, who was a fine young American actor, played Mark, and I played John. It's a three-hander. It's a play set at Christmas Eve, very emotive time. John is someone who has really sunk to the depths through drink, and he's just getting by, and on Christmas Eve, out of nowhere, and after years of not speaking to him, his daughter Mary appears to say that her mother, his wife, is very ill in hospital and is not likely to survive, and would you come and see her? And it's just it's a wonderfully moving, and also, of course, being Connor, very, very funny play, and it was just so wonderful to do it in New York, and it was very successful. We played it with the snow on the ground, which of course made it even more evocative of the time of year. And I ended up getting the Obie Award, which, of course, was absolutely wonderful and led to all kinds of other nice things happening for me in New York.
My next play after Dublin Carol was called Port Authority. And Port Authority was very much to do with love and the experience of love and the confusion of love and how it's very different falling in and out of love. And there's a wonderful lyric by Neil Young, which I always think of. He says, I can't believe how love lets you down, but it looks like and looks like forever in the first place. And there's something about that in that play. There's a search for love. But the way that I had to do it, I knew I would have to sort of return to the monologue to have the freedom, because I suppose I didn't feel I had the craft to put that in a play, which, I don't know, I was, you know, had a fourth wall and was very conventional. To me, it has the best writing of any play that I've done, and because I really sought a kind of artistic freedom in that play. And it concerns three men, who one is young, one is middle-aged, and one is old. And in a way, they talk about a similar experience that they have, and they take turns telling their story. And it has, in a way, it's kind of a mood piece. I mean, it also is a story which I think is compelling and rocks along and all of that. But at the same time, it has something of Beckett about it, in its just in its doggedness and its freedom to go where it wants. And I had a wonderful cast in that: Aina McLeam, I had Stephen Brennan, and again Jim Norton. And that play was so important for me. We opened it in the West End, actually. It opened in the West End and then came to the Gate in Dublin. And really, that play, in terms of its writing for me, has passages in it that I think I probably will never be able to achieve again. There's just something so intense. And it was to do with really the problems, I suppose, I was having too at that time, where you're leaving that stage of being young and having, you know, and realizing that you have responsibilities, but also that perhaps relationships that have hung over from when you were even a teenager will change, and you know, necessarily people change as they grow up. And it was dealing with the disappointment of that, but also really at the same time was affirming very much that love is real, and that's a real force and a real energy, and it's not to be trifled with, and it can hit you from anywhere, and some people don't believe in it, but it's so, as an evolutionary force, it's obviously so strong, because it needs to be, otherwise the human race would stop. And in its path, we are tiny and we are helpless. And I called the play Port Authority for a number of reasons. One was because my drink of choice at that time was port, and I thought, in a way, that I wanted to remind myself that that was how it had been written. And so the sort of port and author there, and but also as well just the sense of a kind of people coming through a place who don't really know each other, but they can connect, and we can all have a lot in common, and that place is life.
The Port Authority happened in 2001. It wasn't all that long after we finished the run of The Weir on Broadway. And I remember thinking, you know, what am I going to do next? How can you possibly top that? When in the post came this script from Connor himself, a play called Port Authority. An extraordinary play. It's really a dream play, because you're not told where the characters are or where the play is set. And I rang Connor and I said, you know, tell me about what's happening. What, you know, I always feel, you know, what's the intention of the author? And the great thing about doing plays by living authors is they can tell you. You don't have to spend hours with your head in your hands trying to work it out. So I said, Connor, just give me a brief intro into the play. And he said, well, these three men, he said, have been summoned to the theatre by God, or indeed by Connor McPherson, and they can't leave the stage until they've told the truth. So I thought, well, this is great. Now I know what it's all about. So it's extraordinary because, of course, it's a play with three actors in which there are interlocking monologues. And I got a bit concerned about, you know, just the actor's natural fear of, will I be able to hold the audience with this 2.5-page speech? And Connor said, well, of course, Connor was directing this. It was the first time I worked with him as a director. And he's one of those directors who does good by stealth. He just sits at the back of the room and lets you get on with it. And as long as you're doing what's right, he's fine. Once you step out of line, he's in there, like, you know, like a laser beam. So, yes, I said, you know, my only concern is these monologues. I mean, they're wonderful. I mean, I'm fascinated reading them, but I'm concerned about my ability to do them. And he said, well, think of it this way. They're not written as monologues. He said, when you start a long speech, you don't intend making a long speech. You say the first sentence, and then you think of another sentence. You add it to that. And eventually it's like a string of beads. You've got a big string of beads, but you didn't intend to have a necklace when you started out. And I remember approaching the speeches that way. My first speech began something like, Sister Pat knocked while I was getting dressed. I could smell breakfast being served. And I thought, that is brilliant. I can smell breakfast being served. In other words, a smell can conjure up an image, a visual image for this man. And that's the way I worked on it, a sentence at a time. And the interesting thing about working on this show with Connor, Stephen Brennan played Dermot and Aina McLean played Kevin. We actually rehearsed separately. We didn't rehearse together because on stage the characters never refer to each other. We're all in our own little bubble. And whether we're alive or dead, I still don't know to this day. But he had this wonderful device where a bell rang. And when the bell rang, the actor had to step forward and deliver his monologue and then retreat to his seat. And the next person came forward. And of course, as the play develops, you realize that all their lives are interlocked. The young boy, Kevin, turns out to be Joe's grandson. And Dermot, the middle-aged man, turns out to be the son of Joe's next-door neighbor, the woman that he was in love with. What happened was Joe went to a party in this woman's house, their next-door neighbor. She and her husband and children lived next door, and Joe and his wife and children lived in the other house. Joe went to a party in the house one night and met this woman and just fell in love with her. He never expressed this love to anybody. He never admitted it until now in this play towards the end of his life. He's trying to make sense of it because at the beginning of the play, he gets a parcel, and in the parcel is a photograph of a woman, this next-door neighbor of his, who has now died. Being a woman, of course, she has realized quite quickly that Joe is in love with her, even though it's unspoken. And in her will, she leaves a note to the effect that when she dies, she wants this photograph sent to Joe. So when he gets it, he knows that she has died. And he also knows, to his horror and shame and embarrassment and sadness and disappointment, that she was aware of the fact that he cared so much about her. But Joe's one of those people who did things by the rules. And the play, from Joe's point of view, is all about consequences. You know, somebody once said that maturity is about being aware of the consequences of your actions. Well, Joe decides not to act on his feelings and, as a result, lives a very sad, lonely, arid life. His wife dies, and he is still living next door to this woman who comes and makes his dinner from time to time, but he never actually tells her what he feels because he thinks it would be inappropriate. And it's a truly beautiful play about loneliness, I suppose, and it's about loss, and it's about redemption. And again, it's a work of amazing maturity by a young man, as Conor McPherson was then.
Come On Over was a short play which I wrote as part of three one-acts which were to be performed at the Gate Theatre. The other two plays were a play called White Horses by Neil Jordan and a play called The Alta Game by Brian Friel. I look back on it now and I realise that myself and Neil were sort of the warm-ups for the main event, which was The Alta Game, which was an extraordinary play. And Come On Over, for me, was my farewell to monologues. Halfway through the play, the monologue structure breaks down and the characters start talking to each other, and I wanted to put the actors in sackcloths, in a kind of way. I put bags over their heads with just little eye holes and hole for their mouth, and Jim Norton and Dervla Molloy, who were the wonderful actors that I had in it, were so brave doing it. It was a very, very difficult piece, and it was at that time when all that stuff was really starting to come out about priests and sex abuse and the church, and it was all so messy, and the sexuality was kind of really weird. It was strange, and everybody, I think, was feeling a bit strange and a bit dirty and a bit funny. And that was my stab at that. I remember I'd been at a reading one time where I heard Michael Harding read from a play that he wrote called The Kiss, And that was a play about a priest who kissed a boy and how, you know, everything unfolded in his life from that into a sort of a terrible chaos. And I was kind of having a go at a similar kind of area. In a way, I look at that play now, it's too on the money for me. It's a little too, you know, it's too obvious. But still an important play because, as I say, it was very much my farewell to the monologues. They tried to tell the story to the audience, take turns, but the woman in the play really starts to take issue with what the man is saying, and it breaks down, and it's broken down ever since. There's no more monologues.
Yeah, we did come on over in 2001. It was for the Dublin Theatre Festival. And again, it was a play that Conor was going to direct, so I didn't need to be asked a second time. Working with Conor is such a joy. And this was a two-hander, which Dervla Malloy and I played, in which we play the two parts. It is a very strange, I suppose, experimental, surreal play. I found it very dark and disturbing, but fascinating to do. I played the part of Father Matthew, and Dervla played Margaret, and they had been childhood sweethearts before Matthew decided that he had a vocation to the priesthood, and he became a Jesuit. He went to Africa. He now investigates miracles for the Vatican. That's basically what his job was. But of course, there's a great deal of sadness and indeed guilt in him. And he obviously has come all the way back to Ireland to see this woman, to try somehow to make sense of his life. It's as if he's in confession and he's trying to make sense of this sin that he committed. He had an affair with a young girl that he was supposed to be looking after. So really he has been a total disaster, and in his own mind he is close to the end, and he needs someone to talk to, and the only person he can really communicate with is Margaret, because they knew each other as children and as young adults. And maybe he should have stayed with her, and maybe they should have got married, because his life has been a disaster and her marriage has been very unhappy. So it was a fascinating play. And one of the interesting things about it is that both the characters, both of us, wore hoods. In other words, we had hoods over our faces. So there were just these little eyelets through which we could see, but the audience didn't see our faces. So you really had to concentrate on the dialogue. And it was interesting because even though there were long speeches, it wasn't really like previous plays of Conor where there were actual monologues, because the characters spoke to each other and listened to each other. So it was really a kind of sea change in Conor's writing, away from those plays which I found fascinating, which were mainly monologue plays. This was a play with long speeches, but the speeches were directed by the actors towards each other. One of the fascinating things about this was that wearing the mask over my head meant that the audience couldn't see me. But, you know, actors never see the audience because the lights blind you and you never want to see who's out there anyway. But on this occasion, I found on the first night, when your heart is pounding and you're feeling quite nervous and your palms are sweating, I was able to look out right into the audience and see everybody. And it was an amazing kind of freeing experience, because never in all my years had I been in a play where I could look out and see the audience. So each night I used to delight in watching their reaction and seeing how they reacted to different elements of the play. It was fascinating. I found it very disturbing being inside that mask. And I found being in the mask made me get very deep into the center of the character. And because the character was a very depressed man, it was exhausting doing it every night.
I played the part of Ian in the original production of Shining City by Conor McPherson at the Royal Court.
Actor Michael McElhattan.
Shining City is basically a five-act play, and it's essentially a two-hander. It's about a man who comes to a therapist because he has seen the ghost of his dead wife and he desperately needs help. But as we discover, as the five acts unfold, the therapist is the one actually probably in more need of therapy than he is. It's revealed in the second act that he's got a girlfriend and also that he's an ex-priest. Then there is
essentially a monologue for half an hour by the client who comes in, and then we discover in the fourth act that he's actually possibly gay and has brought a rent boy back. So they're quite shocking revelations as this thing reveals itself. And but for me, I have to say, I did find I was on stage for five acts solidly, and an awful lot of gear changes, and a lot of times we were just sitting listening for half an hour saying nothing. But it was an amazing experience and a fantastic play.
Yeah, it was in June 2004. I played John, character called John, in Shining City by Colin McPherson.
Actor Stanley Townsend.
Started in the Royal Court, and then we brought it to the Gate Theatre in Dublin. A seminal piece of work for me. Some characters, they're like people, but they are people. But as far as how you relate to them, they're like people. Some people you get to know really well, really quickly, really easily. That was the way with John for me. There was a lot of talk at the time that Connor's plays were just that, talk, monologues. And John, you know, has a lot to say, uninterrupted. But it's in the context of a therapy session. So there's no direct address to the audience. You're just talking. Well, you're talking to your therapist, but, well, you're talking to yourself. John was a man who hadn't talked to anyone for a very long time. So he had about 2 years of grief to express to this man, which he duly did. And the therapist character, Ian, played by Michael Hatton, he started out the play really healthy, well, positive, starting a business. And my man John was deep in grief and despair. So there's a series of three sessions of therapy through the evening. And just somewhere around the middle of the second scene, we reckon that John has become as healthy as Ian is now unhealthy. And so the two characters have mirror journeys, one from illness to health and the other from health to illness. The other thing I really admired about Connor's ability to tell story is how he reveals character. I mean, you know, as an actor, you assimilate all the history of the character, and then, well, you say the words you're given. But it's the words that Connor gives you. It just keeps the audience hanging on. Oh, no, he's that kind of character. Oh, no, he didn't do that. He did that. He's just a fantastic storyteller. When we meet John the first time, he goes to visit a therapist. He's a widower. He's lost his wife maybe 2 years before. And the relationship wasn't good before her death. And her death was sudden. She died in a car crash. And he suffers guilt, because maybe he should have been driving her that night or whatever. And anyway, he eventually sees her in the house, sees her ghost, and hears her ghost, and has to leave the house, can't stay there at night anymore, and moves into a B&B down the road. And a final act of desperation, after about 3 or 4 months of lonely bed and breakfast living, he goes to see a therapist, which is when we first encounter him.
Shining City, which we premiered at the Royal Court in 2004, was a play which for me came from my attempts at finding a good psychotherapist. I found it quite difficult. I'd spent a few years sort of trying a bit of therapy and not kind of relating to the person or moving on and so forth. But what I came away kind of thinking from those experiences, after I actually found a very good psychotherapist and did some very successful work there, which stood me in good stead, I'm happy to say, I came away thinking, you know what, a lot of psychotherapists, you know, are kind of messed up people. You know, they are attracted to dysfunction, and that is what keeps them sane. And, you know, maybe that, you know, people can disagree with that, but it was something that occurred to me. And Shining City became a play about the encounter between a man who's looking for help after he's seen the ghost of his wife who's died in a car crash. And he finds this therapist who has just started his practice, who is a guy who was training to be a priest, but knock that on the head, but still has a kind of a longing to be a healer of some kind. And there are perhaps people said there's echoes of the Gigli concert around the play. I think that's a fair comment. I don't think it was a conscious thing. The Gigli concert is a very powerful play, but I think Shining City is doing something altogether different to the Gigli concert. Shining City is very much a ghost story, which at its heart is going after very metaphysical concerns. And we see these two men, the patient and the therapist, struggling in both areas of their life. And as the patient begins to sort of figure himself out and get well with the help of this therapist, the therapist is sort of going in completely the opposite direction, and his life is becoming more and more, is breaking down more and more, and to the point where he actually begins to be haunted by the ghost that it has been haunting the client. And that play enabled me to really move away from monologues, in the sense that although there are passages in the play where, you know, the client is telling his story, I was always able to keep him on the course that the client wanted him to stay on by constantly interrupting him. And I was also able to break up the play with scenes from the therapist's life. Very important play for me, Shining City. It sort of was the first, in a way, proper play that I had written since Dublin Carol. It wasn't monologues, and it was very much a play, and it was important for me to do that. The play had great success at the Royal Court and then came here to the Gate, and then it was on an American production in on Broadway last year. And what was intriguing for me to see was that how English, Irish and American audiences all reacted to that play in exactly the same ways, in exactly the same moments, and were freaked out by it in exactly the same way, which was very, very gratifying, because you really feel that you're in control of your art when you see that happening in different countries. And there's a gleeful kind of feeling that you get, that you kind of go, you feel very mischievous, because you think, oh my God, like, it, actually with this power comes a kind of responsibility. And we really freaked the audiences out, and we enjoyed doing it.
The Seafarer is Conor McPherson's most recent play, and I think in many ways his best play, because it has an accessibility and a universality that moves it into the arena of being a great European play. I mean, I think the real test of a great writer is that even though this play is set in Dublin, a place I know very well, set in Dublin on Christmas Eve, it's a play that speaks to everybody. And I think that's why it has been so successful. We opened it at the National Theatre around 2006, around Christmas, and it had a great success there. And then we took it on tour, a short tour in England, and it's now going to Broadway. We're going to Broadway in September of this year, 2007. We open in November, and hopefully it'll have a nice run. It's an extraordinary play. It's absolutely wonderful. It's like a fable. It's a story of two brothers, and their difficult life together, Richard Harkin and his brother Sharkey. Sharkey is trying to give up the booze. He's trying to hit drink, because he's had a lot of troubles in his life. And Richard, the character I play, is a very irascible, deeply unpleasant man who is sadly a drunk, an alcoholic. He's recently gone blind. He claims that his blindness was caused by falling into a skip on Halloween, a likely story. He was a former window cleaner, but now does nothing except sit around making trouble for everybody. And the play takes place on Christmas Eve. As I said, Sharky's come back to visit with Richard because he doesn't want him to be alone at Christmas. And a couple of friends come in, and the intention is to have a nice Christmas drink, something to eat, and to play poker. The arrival of a stranger, a person that they don't know very well, changes the whole play, because this man isn't what he seems. In fact, as the play develops, you find out that he is actually the devil, or Old Nick. And he has come to claim the soul of my brother, Sharky, because years before, Sharkey had been in a fight in a pub and killed a man. He was put in the Bridewell overnight in a cell with this other man with whom he played cards. First thing the next morning, he's let go free. And now this man, in other words, the devil, has come for his soul. It's payback time. It's a fabulous play. It's deeply disturbing, very, very funny, and by turns. And I think it's a masterpiece. And I think that Connor McPherson has made a huge leap forward in terms of writing what is has been proved to be, and I hope will go on being that, a great commercial success.
I played Nicky Giblin in the recent production of The Seafarer by Conor McPherson at the National Theatre in England. It was Conor's debut at the National Theatre, and quite a break for Conor in that there were no monologues in the play, and without doubt his funniest play to date. It's all set on Christmas Eve, and it's five guys, and they end up playing a game of cards. But one of the people who arrive turns out to be the devil, and he's playing cards for the soul of this other character, Sharkey. But the great device that Connor uses that the other three characters are never on stage when the devil is talking to the guy whose soul he's going to play. And so the audience feel they've got one up on three of the characters at least in the play, and it works a treat. So the character of Sharkey is a character who doesn't really say very much until the end. He's just in turmoil the whole time. Is he going to hell? Is he not going to hell? And it's a character that is kind of goes through a lot of Connor's plays. Certainly the therapist that I played in Shining City has this character that doesn't say much but just reacts. And we watch this inner churning and an emotional thing, which is a very powerful, powerful thing to watch, I think, on stage, if it's done properly.
I began to become intrigued after I wrote Shining City with Newgrange, and I wanted to write something which captured the essence of Newgrange, which for me was so mysterious, how these guys and women 5,000 years ago, which is before Stonehenge, before the pyramids, managed to build a structure with such astronomical nous that on the morning of the shortest day of the year, in the dead of winter, that the sun would shine directly into what people think was a tomb, a place of death. And there was something so beautiful and magical about that for me, that I tried to write a play which was to do with all of that pagan stuff, which didn't quite work. But then I kept going and started to write another play, which became The Seafarer, which is set at the winter solstice. And for me, it's a couple of days out, but Christmas Eve and the Christian story really, I think, is based on stories which are much older than that. I think Christianity has used pagan iconography, and The Seafarer is set in a house in Baldoyle on Christmas Eve, and it's about a man called Sharkey who has to come back to this house where he doesn't want to be, which is the scene of all his tragedies of growing up, which he hates, to look after his brother who's gone blind, and he hates his brother and his brother hates him. And he arrives to look after him a few days before, and the character who's looking after his brother is called Sharkey. And there's really a lot of Samuel Beckett's play Endgame in The Seafarer, where Sharkey's brother Richard is kind of like the Ham character in that, and Sharkey's a bit like Clove. He's the sort of the servant serving the blind master. And through the as the morning turns to afternoon, it transpires that another friend of theirs has slept in the house, and he gets up and he's in trouble with his wife. And then they go down to the pub and they come back, and they bring more people back with them. And really what happens in the play is that the devil has arrived into the house as one of the people who's tagged along, and he is there to play cards for Sharkey's soul. And so it's very much, that's also based on obviously the Hellfire Club story, which had always intrigued me when I was growing up. And I knew that there would be a great play in that if I could get it right. And so the whole second act of The Seafarer is the card game where Sharkey's playing for his soul. The other characters don't realise that. And his brother, who hates him, is constantly giving him a hard time, has no idea that this is happening. They're just playing cards. And in the end, you know, I managed to bring the audience to a place where it all seems very, very dark and bleak. But what I wanted to happen was I wanted the sun to hit the centre of the death and the darkness, like in Newgrange. And so I won't say how, because people will get to see the play at the Abbey Theatre. But I did manage to do that, and I was very pleased with the play, because it was technically very, very difficult to write. Because first of all, to write a card game is very tricky, because you've got to keep on top of everything that's happening at every time, and also keep the play moving forward and tell the story and allow the audience, who may know nothing about poker, to understand what's happening. It was it was so hard to write, actually, because it was so purely technical. And at certain times I just wanted to go into what I can write quite easy, which is just, that's this guy just goes into a kind of a speech here, you know what I mean? Because I can do that till the cows come home. But I was very conscientiously didn't allow that to happen. And so it's, for me, my most technically accomplished play, in that it's built to last. And I'm pleased to say it worked.
I think the interesting thing about the Seafarer is that he's got these five pretty unredeemable men, and by the end of it, hopefully we love them and we care for these people. I mean, they're not evil men, but they're you know, they're lazy, slobby, selfish alcoholics, basically. And he redeems them all, and it is certainly a through line in all of Connor's works. I think he redeems all his characters. And that is the fantastic thing about his writing, that we care about the characters that he writes about. And that's why they're a joy to watch, and they're an absolute joy to play for an actor.
I think Connor is a true poet of the theatre, because every line, every utterance, and crucially, every silence is so earned. So that what happens in a play, I think, always happens somewhere between the stage and the audience, is he charges up that space, makes it metaphorical, makes it emotional, makes it philosophical, and makes it spiritual. And I particularly love, in terms of the Irish tradition, and I say this not from an academic standpoint, and I say it from an English perspective, is his use of idiom and rhythms. So I have the sort of brain, I can't retain any line from a play. I couldn't quote you a line from Shakespeare. But there's something about the particular rhythms of thought in Connor's plays that I can remember. And the way he uses the particular rhythm of a character to get at how they're thinking and feeling, I think is sublime. So Brendan, the barman at the beginning of the Weir, talking to Jack and Jim about whether he should put caravans on his clifftop hills. And he says something like this. I'll see whether I can quote it. If you had all the families up there on their holliers, you'd feel the evenings turning when they'd be leaving. And no matter how quiet it is now, it'd be fucking shocking quiet then. You know. Now, the way that the cadences of that line get you at a way of thinking, the way, in my English presumption, he uses a Gaelic structure, yet English language, I think is just truly meaningful and artistic. So I think he's an incredibly important writer because of his relish of the theatrical, purely through incredible confidence with language, which is everything, really.
When I look back on all the plays that I've done over the years, I mean, I think the concerns that keep popping up are simply the difficulties people have struggling to live a normal life. And that those, to me, are really big struggles. I mean, often I see articles in the newspaper about why aren't our playwrights writing about the Celtic Tiger and writing about the political situation that Ireland is in and all that. And I think that stuff is all very interesting, but I think we need all kinds of writers. Me, I'm more at the musical end of the spectrum, where I will always be making plays which really are, their ambition is to become a kind of a music, and which reflect simply the feeling of what it's like to be alive and that's a very strange feeling. It's not an ordinary, normal thing. We don't all just get it. We don't all just manage to successfully negotiate our lives. That it's a big journey, and that I try to generate that feeling in the audience. That's what I want to do. That they recognize that feeling. It's a feeling that you can't even name. It's the human condition, I guess. But that's what I'm after. And because that's an endless journey, I know the road ahead is still very long for me. I'm almost 36 now, but I mean, really, I've been writing plays for like 18 years, and I really feel that I'm only ever at any time I'm only really beginning. I've only scratched the surface, and it's an endlessly fascinating endeavor. And if I can do it to half the degree that I've managed now of success, I think that will be a very full and a very satisfying life.
Well, Connor directed both Shining City and The Seafarer, and I know there's a lot of criticism saying should playwrights direct their own work, and generally because they are in love with their words, but Connor's instinct is probably different to a lot of other writers in that he always wants to pare away, pare it right down to the bone. He has no qualms about killing his babies, as they say. And I think that is one of the great advantages. Sometimes, you know, he'll cut speeches and chunks of stuff that you've already learnt and the actor is devastated. But that is his strength, certainly as a writer and as a director.
There's a constant search in my plays for meaning. And instinctively, human beings have looked for meaning beyond the borders of birth and death, because it has to be something bigger than us. I don't necessarily believe in a God who has any interest in us. I don't know where the universe came from. But to me, the mystery and the wonder of that is enough. To me, that's huge. And not to know is beautiful. It's a wonderful, beautiful privilege to be a conscious being. And if you think about it, that perhaps we are the only conscious animals in the entire universe, and there are people who say that there may be infinite universes and infinite dimensions, and that we are just in one tiny little sliver of everything that exists. If perhaps, and there is a chance, we are the only conscious beings who know we're alive and that we will die, we may be the part, the only part of the universe that's aware of itself. That is a massive, massive thing for me. And it's like, what a wonderful opportunity to be here and to be able to try and make something out of that. It's mind-blowing. I'll never get to the bottom of why we're here. I mean, nobody will, but you've got to keep an open mind. It's like what Neil Young says. He says, I'm just trying to keep the door open and let the wind blow.
The playwright in profile was Conor McPherson. The contributors were Kieran Ahern, Mike Bradwell, Jason Byrne, Dominic Drumgool, Brona Gallagher, Garrett Keogh, Michael McElhattan, Connor Mullen, Jim Norton, Ian Rickson, and Stanley Townsend. Playwrights in Profile is broadcast on RTE Radio 1 on Sunday evenings and is available as podcast and extended podcast on the RTE website. The series is compiled and presented by Sean Rocks.